city. But we're doing Ibn Ezra. And Ibn Ezra's material is inside here. So what you want to do is turn to source number 80. Source number 80. We did most of the first 79. The last 2 months. Okay. A little background on Ibn Ezra.
On the other side.
80 is at the bottom of a page. Source number 80.
Source number 80.
Look at page 11.
It says 80.
It says
75
on the top.
11
on the corner.
What? Some of these.
It goes to 72 on the bottom here, and then it goes to 81.
Oh my goodness.
There's an 81.
So maybe this is
72.
Page 11.
Look at page 11.
Top
11. I'm not sure what happened to the top there, but.
I see 72, and then it goes.
I think that someone made a copy for me.
I'm missing. Yeah, something's missing.
Okay.
Here. You read the Hebrew, not me. Do you have one? Did you end up getting it?
Okay, I'm sorry. Something went wrong with the way these copies were made, so.
She gave me hers.
That's okay, they'll lose this. Okay, listen, source number 80 is going to go quickly. We'll move right to 81 and 82. Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
Play a musical.
Source number 80 is a very rare source. It has never been printed maybe that's why you can't find it. No, it's actually, I got this from a very rare book on the fourth floor of the library at Yeshiva University, at the Gottesman Library. And actually, I was able to get a copy of it when someone said, shh, when no one's looking, just copy it on the machine. This is a small book on grammar that Ibn Ezra wrote. And in his introduction, he writes what he thinks of Rashi. And that's what I have underlined here. And he writes, he says, V'hadoros haba'im samu kol drash ikar v'shoresh. The more recent generations have made the study of drash to be so important as to overshadow all other disciplines of study. And he says, Kirav Shlomo Zal, like, doesn't mention calling Rashi. Rashi wasn't called Rashi until quite a bit after he was no longer around. He was known in his lifetime as either Kuntres, the pamphleteer, we discussed that already some weeks ago, or just plain Rabbeinu Shlomo. And he called Rabbeinu Shlomo Zal Shapirei Shatanach Al Das Drash, or Al Derech Drash. Rashi explained the Bible through his own eyes and his own lens of drash. For who choshev kihu al derech pshat. Rashi thinks that he's pshat. How do we know that? Because he keeps saying so. He writes all over his perush. Ani lo basi el lepshuto shamikra. Right, in Rashi's defense, we said that Rashi, after writing lepshuto shamikra, says ula agada hamiyasheves divrei mikra. But I will introduce drash or an agada if I think the text needs to be placated or appeased or settled. The difference between Rashi and Ibn Ezra is that Ibn Ezra thinks that this text is already settled. Doesn't need more settling. It's fine as it is. You don't have to darshan. Rashi says, no, it's not fine as it is. When I have a pasuk that says, look at this, Vayakshitu, this week's parsha, Et Yosef, they stripped Yosef, et kutanto,
of his coat.
Yeah.
Et ktonet,
plural.
Hapasim, I've used this example in the past, asher olav.
The plural somewhere.
Now, if you see this pasuk in this week's parsha, when they saw Yosef, they stripped him of his cloak, the cloak of stripes or of long sleeves that was upon him. When you see a pasuk like this, and this is not part of a poem, or it's not part of a shira, or it's not part of, let's say, remember the way Lamech talks to his wives, listen carefully, Shma'an It says, Oda v'tzila shma'an b'koli, neshe lemech ha'azina imrosi. It's clearly poetry, it's clearly repetitious. So do you have to explain every single letter of that of those two phrases to say something different? Mm-hmm. But here, this is not part of that prose. Could have, this pasuk should have just said, v'yefshitu et Yosef et k'tones ha'pasim asher alav. Pasuk could have just as easily left out those the second line, right? So Ibn Ezra will look at this and say, that's the way the Torah talks. The Torah is flowery. The Torah is very expressive. You don't have to break down every single word. Now, if you recall, until now, we cut Rashbam from the same kind of cloth. The Rashbam says the same. What does Rashi say about that first kutunto?
Outer strip.
It was an outer coat. This is not the same ketones here. This are two different coats. Okay, you can't say v'yafshitu et Yosef et kutonto klomar et ktones hapasim asher alav, because why would the Torah waste words on that? You hear?
A spiritual cloak?
Okay. No. So this is the function of a difference between Rashi and Ibn Ezra. V'yotzaras hashamayim v'lo yihye matar. Ibn Ezra says there won't be rain. Then what does William Atar mean? Same thing. Right? Mm-hmm. But his eyes grew dim from seeing. Rashi will not have Vatichena Einov to mean the same thing as Vatichena Einov Meraos. Ibn Ezra says that's not a problem. His eyes grew dim from seeing. I know that word is extra, but that's the way people talk. Okay, now that you got to have that introduction, Ibn Ezra looks at all of this and says that's drash. And look what he writes afterwards. V'ein b'sfarov pshat rak echod mini elef. In my opinion, every 1,000 perushim of Rashi, I come across pshat once. One in 1,000. The chachmei doreinu yishalalu ba'ela hasfarim. Our wise men of these generations love this kind of material. He's right. Rashi was much more popular than Ibn Ezra. Rashi has engendered over 300 commentaries. 300 super commentaries to Rashi. Ibn Ezra has 9, Rashbam has only 1. Right? Now, when Ibn Ezra wrote his commentary, remember he is 4 years older than Rashbam, and he's living in a world that has already considered Rashi. Rashi in his lifetime was considered extremely famous. In his 20s he was already famous. So that especially his commentary to the Talmud already gave his commentary to the Tanakh a certain acceptance. Ibn Ezra, in contrast, was a nobody in his time. He was not known, not quoted by contemporaries. The few times he seems to quote someone else, that person himself who became famous quotes a totally different interpretation. I'll give you a few examples of this. Ibn Ezra was not a world player in his time. And he writes how disappointed he is about that. He traveled the world. He hardly ever stayed in one place. And when he writes in his travels, nobody knows him.
Oh.
And he spent time teaching people lessons over what it means not to know me. And he writes about that. And we'll talk of some stories of Ibn Ezra maybe the second or third week that we talk about. But in his writings have a certain appeal to us as, let's call us maybe Torah Umada kind of thinkers, let's say, more rationalist kind of thinkers. If I presented you with 4 or 5 psukim from any parsha in the Torah, certainly from narrative, if I presented you with some psukim and I said, go ahead, use a dictionary, use a grammar book, use whatever you want, but no perush. You cannot look up in any Gemara, any Medrash, any perush. I want you to explain these 5 psukim. What you come up with today will be look closer to Ibn Ezra than to Rashi. Maybe we'll try this exercise. Just explain these psukim, and you'll see that what you come up with is closer to Ibn Ezra. A few points have to be made here. Ibn Ezra was from the Spanish world. Rashi was from the French world.
Mm-hmm.
The French world was certainly much more traditional. They were not exposed to the philosophical and grammatical world that Ibn Ezra was familiar with by speaking Arabic and by being exposed to the Muslim world. Right? That being said, Ibn Ezra still is far more traditional than Rashbam, and I want to start our tonight's lecture with that. Last week, I mentioned we finished the Northern French school, and I mentioned that some of the Northern French commentaries after Rashi were extremely independent. They had their own way of reading Torah, and they would explain the text with such a penchant for pshat that they would disregard any famous medrash you might have heard. I think I gave one famous example is the woman that Moshe married that irked his sister. Who would be that person? How does the Torah describe that person? She's called Isha Kushit Asher Lakach, right? And there's pretty much a consensus amongst all the Mefarshim that this Isha Kushit refers to Tzipora, right? Miriam degraded her brother for the marriage to the Isha Kushit right after Eldad Umedad, these two out of 72 helpers from Moshe were set aside, remember? So Rashi cites just the very end of a medrash that these two were complaining to their wives over this lost opportunity. And the wives, in turn, were complaining, oh, our husbands almost had a chance to be a Navi. What an opportunity they lost. And Tzipora heard this and said, what, are you kidding? You want your husband to be a Navi? Let me tell you what it's like to be the wife of a Navi. So Miriam overheard this.
Right.
And she started wanting to help her brother's family life. And she said, well, what? Our brother does not pay any attention to his wife and has already rejected her and doesn't spend any time with her and has no connection to her. What are you talking about? We're prophets too. We speak to God. God only speaks to him. He speaks to us. And we maintain family ties. Right? So you've heard this. This sounds familiar, right? I'm not bringing anything new. This is found in Rashi. And Rashbam says, it says, Isha Kushit, she was an Ethiopian woman. And that's it. Right? That's Rashbam. Ibn Ezra accepts the Kabbalah of Chazal that this was Tzipora. This will just be the beginning of many examples where you'll see that Ibn Ezra is much more traditional than Rashbam. Ibn Ezra tries to stick with what the Gemara says, especially if it's a halacha. Right? Ibn Ezra, it's an interesting connection between this introduction and today's Daf Yomi. Today's Daf Yomi has a few examples of inheritance law that seems to fly in the face of the pshat of the pasuk in the Torah. And Ibn Ezra writes about this, and it says, you must read the Torah according to the way the Gemara says. Don't give your own independent explanation. You have to read it the way the halacha says. Now, Ibn Ezra betrays us here, because there are so many times in his parish where he does give an independent material. Ibn Ezra is much harder to read than Rashbam in this regard. Because Rashbam, you know, throughout his parish, he just has a straight pshat. And you know what he does when he can't give pshat? He doesn't say anything. He says, go look at my grandfather's parish. I have nothing to say here. Pshat is not endowed with an ability to explain these parshios. And in these parshios, Ibn Ezra becomes a great darshan. Okay, I see a couple questions here. Yes?
Why an eye for an eye? Does Rashbam paint that he for a monetary amount?
So there, we can possibly prove from the text itself that there are what we call exceptions what's called lex talionis. That pasuk, an eye for an eye, is mentioned in a number of places in the Torah. The first time it appears is when a man hits a pregnant woman, and the fetus departs. Right, so the lex talionis of that section, and the Gemara in Bava Kamma addresses this: how we can, if through a drash, determine ayin tachasayin. It's not usually binding on Rashbam, and it's interesting. We do see a rishon. Avraham ben Arambam says that originally the law was lex talionis in the desert, and then when they became more cultured and cultivated, then the law became money for an eye. Rashbam could have written that. So you see, which I know what you're arguing. You see, Rashbam also gives in. You know, is there a pshat? Rashbam would also. Yes, I'm not going to say that everything he's a Karaite, right? Okay, so Rashbam does say the inisim es nafsho sechem on Yom Kippur is fasting. Right, that's another good example. But he proves it through what he calls pshat. Yes. He is from everywhere. In Spain. In Spain. But he's you know what? Nothing is known about his birth. What we do know is that he traveled throughout his whole life around the whole world. You see some of his Perushim. He writes, for instance, about the Tower of Babel and how tall he thought it was. He says, all the commentaries of my age put it to the height of hundreds of feet. Well, I once went mountain climbing in Europe, and I found that it's very hard to breathe up there. So how could they build it so tall? He says that where it says that the Israelites built a Mishkan with acacia wood, right? And it says in the Medrash, where did they get acacia wood in the desert to build such a structure? Anyone remember? Yaakov planted it. That's Rashi. Rashi says that Yaakov planted it on the way down to Egypt so they would have it for a Mishkan. Ibn Ezra says, what do you mean that? I traveled many deserts and I've seen acacia wood all over North Africa. Who, did Yaakov plant those? He says the acacia wood was there waiting for them. So and God knew it. You don't have to prearrange a system like that. So Ibn Ezra used his travels around the world, just spent his time traveling.
Do we know who he studied with?
He mentions Yehuda Levi, the Kuzari, sometimes in his commentaries. He mentions a lot of different people. And maybe now I'll use this as a segue into another aspect of Ibn Ezra's parish that's very important to understand. But first I want to wrap up what we just did. Ibn Ezra tries to be more traditional in his commentary, both when it comes to accepted traditions, like this famous tradition of who Tzipora was, who the Isha Kushit was, even though it's not pshat. And he also tries to be traditional when it comes to halacha. The Torah says, let the slave who has his ear pierced, let him be a slave ad olam, right? The Eved Olam. Ibn Ezra says that means Adiyovel. Rashbam says the rest of his life. So Ibn Ezra wants to stay with the halacha as much as possible, right? We have to deal with the fact that sometimes when Ibn Ezra disagrees with the halacha, what does that mean? Does that mean he didn't know the halacha? Does it mean he didn't know the Gemara that talks about this halacha? What does that mean? Because Ibn Ezra was not known, certainly not in his day, as the Talmudist that Rashbam was known as. When Rashbam said something, people say, oh, he didn't know this. Or, of course he knew it. He was Rashi's equal in the Talmud. You following? So that no one, Ibn Ezra does not have that reputation. Ibn Ezra is not famous in his time period, quoted by others as an authority. He became an authority when people read the monumental nature of his parish. Okay? I take this opportunity to move now to a second aspect of his commentary. It's essential if you want to be a student of Ibn Ezra on the Torah. He wrote two commentaries to the Torah. That means that there should be 10 books on the Torah of Ibn Ezra. To the Bereishis, to the Shmos, etc., right? We have 6 of those books in our hands today. Wow. The Vatican may have the other 4. I don't know. They may exist someplace. And I'm sure he wrote the other 4, because he makes reference to them in the one of the 6. But when I say we have 6, we have the full 5 of one of those Perushim. And we only have 1 of the second Perush. And while there are different opinions about the scholarship, about the nature of these two Perushim, most scholars come down as follows. That the way to differentiate between these two Perushim is simply by its size. There are 5 Perushim to Ibn Ezra that are quite small. And open up any Mikros Gedolos and you see. In Bereishis, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Devarim, Ibn Ezra is usually a small little box on the page. In Shmos, sometimes he gobbles up half the page. The two Perushim was a short Perush and a long Perush. And the short Perush was written first, the long Perush was written second. Here is the evidence. But before I go there, it's important to point out that we do have the short Perush to Shmos. And when the first Mikros Gedolos is printed in 1524, the Christians who were in charge of this printing, listen to what they did. They thought that the long Perush was superior, that's all they had, so what did they put in? They put in the long one to Shmos, and you are reading two different commentaries. So often in Bereishis, Ibn Ezra says, I'm not going to say what this word means here, look in this Pasuk in Shmos, and it's not there. It's in the short one, which you never saw. No, you never saw it. It's printed in only two volumes so far. Now you'll find it in the Mosad Rav Kook, in the Torah Chaim. It gives the Perush Aroch and the Perush Katzar on the same page. But you've never seen the Mikros Gedolos with two different Perushim of Ibn Ezra, right? Right? So that, you know, often Ibn Ezra and Shmos contradicts the other four books. Simple Perushim. Mamish contradictory. Because he changed his mind over the 40 years that are in between the two. Why does Ibn Ezra only refer to Rashbam in his Perush to Shmos, but not in the other four books? Because when he wrote those shorter Perush, he didn't know Rashbam. He didn't come across Rashbam. They met in London at one point. Ibn Ezra despised Rashbam. Let me explain why. He thought that his Perush was so, with his such penchants for Pshat. When he mentions Rashbam in his Perush, he is such vitriol for this chutzpah of this French Jew who explains the Bible with such a Pshat, such a penchants for Pshat. He comes short of calling him a Karaite. And by all means, he saves his vitriol for Karaites too. But Ibn Ezra is very clever, I must tell you, about the way he mocks some other Perushim. It's usually with some kind of pun or some kind of play on the name of the person. But he blames such misconceptions on Rashbam's Perush. Ibn Ezra in his travels, get this, hold on to your seats. Ibn Ezra in his travels came across Jewish communities that kept Shabbos from Saturday morning till Sunday morning.
Oh my God.
And they were not Karaites. Karaites keep Shabbos Friday night. You know what a Karaite is, right? Karaites are Jews who only keep Torah Shebichsah. They have no Torah Shebichsah. They have no oral tradition. They follow only the written law from the Torah.
When did they keep Shabbos? From when?
From Saturday morning to Sunday morning. But Karaites keep Friday night to Saturday night. Adarabah. On the pasuk by Yerevay Boker Yom Echad, Ibn Ezra polemicizes against Karaites. He says, how do you know they keep Shabbos from Friday night to Saturday night? Right? If you go with the strict pshat of the pasuk, you should keep Shabbos from Saturday morning to Sunday morning. So he's trying to show that Karaites also accept some traditions. Following? So Ibn Ezra wrote a poem against Rashbam. It's called Igeres HaShabbos. Igeres HaShabbos, the Sabbath epistle, it's called in scholarly works. And it's a poem to try to convince Jews to keep Shabbos Friday night to Saturday night. Right? If you were going to use the strict, strict pshat of the Torah, you would probably only keep one holiday from night to night. That would be Yom Kippur. Because it says in Yom Kippur, fast from the night to the night. Logic would indicate that all other days, you start in the morning. You wake up in the morning, the day starts. Right? That's the logical place to start the day. Halacha Moshe Misina, we learn that the day starts at night for all halachos. Right? So Ibn Ezra wrote this poem blaming the observance of Shabbos in his travels on Rashbam. What did you write it in your Perush for? Right? Why write shot like that? So Rashbam, remember you see a few weeks ago? The opening words in Rashbam's Perush. When you read the first words of his Perush, much more firm than Rashi or anyone else, he opens his Perush by saying, the Jews must know that every word of the rabbis in the Talmud and the Midrashim are true and must be obeyed. He knew that because what he writes in his Perush, which is outright heresy in some circles, Rashbam couldn't get a job teaching in any yeshiva today, except maybe YU, because of what he writes in his Perush. Right? Seriously. Who's going to take someone who writes Vavadol Olam Lefi Pshuto Kol Yimei Chayav? The day starts in the morning by Erev Vayboker. He gives Pshatim Mamish against accepted halachos. Right? So Rashbam is going to say, I never told anybody to follow the halacha from my Perush. My Perush is not... Read my Perush in the Talmud for that. This Perush is only for Pshat. Right? Well, I keep reminding people that the words of the rabbis are true and the best way for the Jew to read the text is through Drash, the Drash of the Midrashim and the Gemaras and the Agadotas. But I'm writing a Perush to Pshat because my grandfather didn't. Right? My grandfather didn't succeed. He writes that in his Perush. This week's Parsha is where Rashbam writes, my grandfather admitted to me that had he been younger... We discussed this a few weeks ago. Had he been younger, had he had more time, he would redo his Perush read between the lines, to fit more like mine. I suggested 2 weeks ago that what he meant was about biblical parallelism, right? Remember that share? You can find it online from 2 weeks ago if you weren't here. It's up. So imagine Rashbam making such an admission about Rashi. So look, I got to tell you, Ibn Ezra wasn't fond of Rashi either. He thought that Rashi was too midrashic. He didn't mind the tradition of Rashi, but he thought that Rashi was too midrashic, and he thought that Rashbam went too far in pursuit of Pshat. So Ibn Ezra tries to somehow straddle the line. And let me just finish the topic of the two Perushim. The long Perush appears to have been written very late in his life, the short Perush early in his life. The short Perush is very vitriolic about positions with which he disagrees. He usually mentions the position, mentions the name of the author of this position, and then destroys the argument, and for good measure almost always makes fun of the person's name.
Okay.
If his name is Yitzchok, Hachi Karashmo Yitzchok Kol Hashemeya Dvarav Tzochikolov. Right? This guy, Ben Ephraim, famous one, he says, this man is a Choser Aleph. Get it?
No.
He's Ben Parim. Son of cows. So, and many more like this. And in the long Perush, he quotes Karaites honorably, without ever making fun of their name, even. Right? Mm. So it seems that he lightened up a little, I guess, right?
This wasn't Ibn Ezra, right?
This is Ibn Ezra. This is Ibn Ezra's long Perush. He's more respectful, apparently. And what happens is he never quotes Rashbam in the short Perush, but he quotes Rashbam quite often in the long one with great vitriol, as I said. Rashbam, for instance, says, what is tefillin? What's the real pshat purpose of tefillin? It's like a string around your finger you could look at and remind yourself, oh, God took us out of Egypt. And Ibn Ezra, what? A string around your finger? You're supposed to put parashios inside. You're supposed to put Torah inside. You're supposed to lamenti haTorah Hashem b'ficha. What are you talking about, a string around your finger? And he goes crazy with Rashbam. Now, I'm sure Rashbam wore tefillin. Maybe his brother's tefillin, or Ben Tam, or his grandfather's tefillin, Rashi, but I'm sure he wore tefillin. And I'm sure he kept Shabbos from Friday night to Saturday night. Just that in his Perush, he gave these odd things, if you will. Okay, so this is Ibn Ezra's, between Ibn Ezra's two Perushim. So don't be surprised, like if you read in next week's Parsha, where Ibn Ezra says, when the brothers say, Be Adoni, and Ibn Ezra writes, it's not the place for me to explain what Be means. I'll explain it in Shmos, when Moshe says the word Be to Paro. So on that pasuk, blank, nothing. Because he wrote it in his short Perush, and you're reading his long Perush. So if I've convinced you, try to get the Mosad Rav Kook to Ibn Ezra. The Mosad Rav Kook originally came out with an Ibn Ezra in 3 volumes. The scholarly community was not thrilled with it. The best work on Ibn Ezra to date is a 6-volume work called Mechokake Yehuda, by Yehuda Krinsky. So it's very hard to get, but if you really want to get to the bottom of Ibn Ezra, get that work, Mechokake Yehuda. And then the Mosad Rav Kook has now the Torah Chaim, those blue volumes. I'm sure you've seen them. It's a 9-volume set. This was a piece of cake. By the time they put it out, all they had to do was just take the scholarly editions that Mosad Rav Kook had and just put them on typeset. Right? This is a Mikros Gedolos. This is a Chumash with the commentaries. And this is a Vayikra, so you don't see the Shmos one. What it has, Perish Ibn Ezra HaAroch, and at the bottom it says Perish Ibn Ezra HaKatzar. The long and the short. Okay, but this is what it looks like, and it's in 9 volumes. Okay, let's try to get that if you can. Okay, now I want to do some specific examples of Ibn Ezra. Now, I'm sorry that some pages just didn't get in here. But I want to give one example that's actually not in these sources first. Now, I'll work at... Anybody here knows that this child is Moshe, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me some problems with this It's a pasuk and a half in the beginning of Shmos. What's the problem? If you were writing a commentary, what would you concentrate on in these words? And you know that's child is Moshe. Okay, why would the Torah use this extraneous word? In other words, Joel, reconstruct the pasuk to say what it says in an easier way. Okay, anyone who ever puts a pen to write a parish to the Torah does just that. What is written in the pasuk? What is the pasuk saying? How could the pasuk have said that using fewer words? Right? You studied Occam's razor in philosophy. In other words, you should always say things in as simple a way as possible. And if you're saying it more than the simplest way, there's got to be a reason for that. Right? Now, I think Rashbam and Ibn Ezra might agree with what we just said. Right? It's just that they feel that the Torah is sometimes extraneous and flowery while meaning to be flowery. Ad Yavoram Cho Hashem, Ad Yavoram Zukonisa could have been Ad Yavoram Cho Hashem Asher Konisa. There's some words that are just totally extraneous. V'lo Asu Kasher Diber Aleihem Melech Mitzrayim. They didn't listen to Paro, king of Egypt. Do I need Batzachayin Ese Yeladim? I know that from the beginning of the Pasuk that they let the boys live. Right? So when you confront Psukim like that, you have to say Batzachayin Ese Yeladim means more than just letting them live. They helped them, they fed them, they clothed them, they did other things. Right? And that's what you find in Perish Rashi. Someone like Ibn Ezra doesn't mind the Torah saying, listen to how I use the word klomar. This is Nechama Leibowitz's Knech. It says, V'lo asu kasher diber aleihen melech Mitzrayim, klomar, v'techayena esa yiladim. Do you hear it? They didn't listen to Paro, king of Egypt.
In other words, they let them live.
Right? The Torah sometimes goads you along. Right? Who respects the Torah more? The way Rashi's reading or the way Ibn Ezra's reading it? It's a big machlokas. who is showing more respect for the way the Torah talks? The one who doesn't want the Torah to have any extra verbiage, or the one who says, no, it's flowery, it's extraneous? Okay, I'll leave it. Alright, yes, Joel. Vayelech is extraneous, so what's it doing there? You have to account for it. It's got to do something. Right? What else? That's the way you get married. That's the way
they were married.
How do you know that? Why are you using a preconceived notion here?
They had other children.
Ah, okay. Ask it in a more sharp way. Come on, think of it. If this is Moshe, ask it this way, then, and this is their first marriage, then,
Where are
Miriam and Aaron? Okay. Okay, now can you answer that just quickly? Can you answer that before doing anything else?
It's not the focus of the story.
Right. Prove to me that no one but Moshe is the focus of this story. But just see, by seeing something else that's obviously missing here.
Name.
Names. What about the beginning of Rus that says "V'shem Ha'ish Elimelech V'shem Ishto Naomi"? What about here? "V'shem Ha'ish Vayelech Ish Ushmo Amram Mibeis Levi Veikach Esbas Levi Ushmo Yocheved." I wouldn't think there's anything wrong with that. So it's obvious that the Torah wants to keep everybody else in the background, including this boy's two older siblings, right? And that's where Ibn Ezra does go there. Rashi didn't want to go there. Why didn't Rashi want to go there? Do you remember what Rashi does with this? This was, indeed, the first birth of this marriage. This marriage produced this child first.
They got divorced and remarried.
Right. Because Rashi wants to instill in his readers, when approaching chapter 2 of Shmos, the tremendous difficulties and strains upon young couples just in their daily lives by bringing children into the world. Right? Did you get that in the background, right? And yet, it was Miriam who convinced the father to say, listen, Paro is killing the boys, you're killing the boys and the girls. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with that, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That is what Vayelech is. Do you remember how to midrashically figure Vayelech?
He went after Miriam's advice.
Holach be'atzat bito. You hear it? Holach be'atzat bito. That word, Vayelech, is is midrashically explained to refer to a man going after his daughter's advice. Ve'elech ish achar atzat bito. Right here, ve'elech ish mibeit Levi achar atzat bito. Vayikach et bat Levi. And vayikach here means he remarried her.
Oh.
Okay.
He had divorced.
Right. And this is a remarriage. So that batar isha batel ben. Okay. Right. Can I just do a quick exercise in Rashi? Because one pasuk later it says that they tried to hide this child because of a decree of Paro. Mm-hmm. And the Bible does tell us how long they hid him for.
3 months.
3 months.
Baby was born 7 months.
This is a point of six. This is a point so just figure out 9 months.
Their baby's born 20
but
months.
So that Rashi reads the text saying, if the Bible tells me that they could hide him for 3 months and could no longer hide him afterwards, mm-hmm. there's got to be a reason for me knowing how long he was hidden. Following, if the whole story is about hiding him and trying to come up with a plan and then they couldn't, waiting till he's maybe old enough to sit in a basket, I don't know, but whatever it is, it says they could no longer hide him. So why do I have to know how long they could hide him? Who cares? Whether it's 3 months, 6 months, or 2 weeks.
And they kept track of the pregnancy.
So great, exactly. They kept track of the pregnancy, and according to the Gemara, think of this exercise, according to the Gemara, she was already pregnant before this marriage. She was 3 months pregnant when he took her back. So when the Egyptians saw the remarriage, they said, we're coming back 9 months to see if there's a baby here. Right? The child, Moshe, was born 3 months before that expected visit. Right? And therefore, they were able to hide him for 3 months. That's what the Gemara Masechet Sota says. Rashi, however, rejected that Gemara by saying, an unheard of medrash, it's only found in one place in all of rabbinic literature, Targum Yonasan to the Pasuk, that Moshe was a 6-month baby. There is a Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that lists all the 6-month babies in our tradition. And Moshe is not among them. According to Rashi, Moshe should have been in that list. You hear? So why did Rashi reject the Gemara's interpretation that Yocheved was already expecting 3 months? See, they were divorced for a total of 3 months, but she was expecting the day he divorced her. Of course. This proves that Rashi is not just some automatic pilot accepting everything Chazal say. If she was pregnant before the marriage, this doesn't make sense. If the pasuk had said, Bateled ha'isha bein, and she gave birth to a boy after this remarriage, fine. But when it says, Batar, she conceived after the marriage, then I can't give the Gemara's interpretation. Gemara's interpretation makes no sense. So why does the Gemara say it? That's a strong question. You know why? The Gemara in its interpretation does not have to stand up to the rigors of a pshat or of Rashi. Remember Rashi's Davor Dabur Al Ofnav. At least when Rashi writes a parish, even if it's tinged in drash, it has to read the words of the text. If it's not reading the words of the text, then Rashi's not going to write it.
Right.
Yes. It's an excellent question, but I must tell you, Rashi in the Gemara is not the same person as Rashi in the Tanakh. What I mean is, Rashi in the Gemara acts like the Gemara. There's a Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, for instance, in the Kuf Yud Tes that says a Navi has to be wise. Come from the Vua through wisdom. And Rashi in the Gemara writes, Shneemar b'Navi levav chokhma. It's a pasuk in Zehor. That happens to be a drasha in Bava Basra, in the first parak. On that pasuk in Tehillim, and this is one of 100 such examples I have to tell you. There's a book on just doing this very, but this is a good example. On that pasuk in Tehillim, Rashi writes, this word, v'navi levav chochma, has nothing to do with nevuah. The word navi here means we will bring. V'navi, we will bring to the heart chochma. It's not talking about nevuah. But in the Talmud, Rashi himself, in the Gemara and Shabbos, volunteered this as a proof text that a Navi has to be a Chacham. So, because in the Talmud, Rashi is behaving like the Talmud. He quotes another Gemara saying it. Right? He does this often. When we did an example with Targum Unculus about 4 or 5 weeks ago, that was astounding. He gives in the Gemara in Kiddushin a Targum Unculus, and he says, if you don't agree with this Targum, it's like cursing Hashem. And on that very pasuk, he disagrees with Targum. Right? It means that when Rashi disagrees with Targum, it doesn't mean that he's saying Targum is wrong. It means Targum is not pshat. Right? There's nothing wrong with saying that. There's nothing wrong with saying Rashi rejected the Gemara because the Gemara is not pshat. He's not saying the Gemara is wrong. Right? There's some message to the Gemara. Okay? Okay. So now I would like to do a few additional examples of Ibn Ezra. And first of all, I want to introduce the idea that his perush is extremely clever. What I mean by that is that to an extent like Rashi, he thinks his audience is very intelligent. He writes in cryptic ways that he thinks, you know, he should have made things more easy to understand what exactly he's commenting on. Sometimes you have to really read commentaries to see what's bothering him. And if you think that Rashi is so easy to read, not so fast. It's not so pashut always to figure out what's bothering Rashi in the pasuk. Right? It's a little more difficult for Ibn Ezra's case. So there are maybe if any of you've seen any books of legends of Ibn Ezra, that he's like we don't see stories about Rashi like this. Rashi has a relatively private life. He's not engendered some of these storylines. There's maybe a little legend about how he was born or things like mm-hmm. that. But Ibn Ezra, I have a book at home with about 100 legends of the wisdom of Ibn Ezra and his travels. The source of this material, mostly things Ibn Ezra himself has written. But okay, it's fair enough. But and some of the stories that appear in Ibn Ezra, I must admit, appear in philosophical stories and other involving other people, sometimes Muslims, sometimes even Christians. But so be it. So maybe I'll share one or two with you at the very end of our words. So let's take a look. If you have, I hope you have sources like 87, 88, 89. Do you have that? Did you catch up there? Yeah, there's 87, 88, you know?
Yeah, 91 on the bottom.
86.
I ordered 30 copies of this, of what I'm holding in my hand, and something went wrong, so I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. All right, so I'm just going to read... I'll make sure to have it from this one for next time. I'm not sure what book. Maybe it's 2 pages that eaten up by the machine in between. Okay. Have you ever heard of a man named Nimrod in the Bible?
Of course.
By show of hands, a good guy or a bad guy?
Bad guy.
Okay, don't name your child Nimrod then.
No.
But Ibn Ezra claims that Nimrod was a tzaddik gomor.
Oh, God. He united the
what
people.
Could Nimrod have done to be a tzaddik?
He united them.
No, I don't know. That story I told about Avram taking it back to the tent. Yeah, but he went back on that. Yeah, he said Nimrod was charged an excessive amount because the guests used to say, God will pay it. So he said, you call yourself God, you pay it. Right? So he gave him a bill for like 4 million shekels. So Nimrod agreed, okay, I'm not God, I won't pay it. So that's his tshuva. But Lamaisa, according to Chazal, he was killed by Esav, right, in West of Sparsha. And but Ibn Ezra says he was a tzaddik because it says ki hua yogibor tzayid lifnei Hashem. So what does it mean to be a mighty hunter before God? Ibn Ezra says, you know, when I write my parish, I'm not going to put into mind that his name is Nimrod. You're making prophets out of his parents? Nimrod, because it means let us rebel, that must mean that he's a rebel. Yeah, that's what Rashi writes.
Means
so let
that?
Us rebel. So Ibn Ezra says, I'll just read it. He says, Al tevakesh ta'am l'chol ha-shemot im lo nechtav. Don't give me an explanation of what he is if it's not written in the text. V'hu echel harot gvorot b'nei adam al ha-chayot, ki ha-yogi bort sayed. He was a warrior who showed man's dominion over animals. The pshat is that he was a good guy, he was a tzaddik, was the first person to bring sacrifices to God, the Hadrash Derech Acheres. I admit that the Drash says something else about him. Right? You should see what Ramban says about him. Wait till we get to Ramban a few weeks from now.
All right.
So Ibn Ezra has he was very independent when he wants to be. He says, if there's a Kabbalah that's Ishakushit, is Tzipora, I'm ready to accept that Kabbalah. But I don't think there's a Kabbalah that Nimrod was a Russia. Here's where we run into trouble. And if you can figure out, by taking Ibn Ezra one by one, to figure out what's a Kabbalah and what's not a Kabbalah, please write it up and get yourself a doctoral thesis. I'm serious. There is a member of this shul's son married Uriel Simon's daughter. It's Gnack. Uriel Simon, you know who he is? He's one of the world's preeminent specialists on Ibn Ezra. His own doctoral thesis was in Ibn Ezra. And I remember him speaking 25 years ago about this problem. Why does Ibn Ezra accept some Kabbalahs? He writes his famous point, is in Kabbalah Nekabel. If you have a Kabbalah that this is true, I'm willing to accept it. Now, Ibn Ezra will not write that about water rising out of a well into Rivka's pail, like Rashi writes. He's not going to write, if you have a Kabbalah, because he doesn't believe in that, it's possible. Right? Ibn Ezra explains what looks like unusual behavior that's written in the Torah, like a donkey talking to Bilam, as a metaphor for something else. Right? That it didn't really happen. If the text had written that Avram's servant saw water rising out of the well into her pail, he would have written that is not to be taken literally. So Ibn Ezra doesn't write in Kabbalah Nekabel and those kind of perushim. He's aware of what's in the Midrashim. He writes Kabbalah Nekabel on things that are really quite believable, right? But it doesn't make sense to me that the Torah would make such a big deal about Sarah giving birth at the age of 90. Can you see where I'm going with this? And be silent at Yocheved giving birth at 130.
Oh,
who says Yocheved gave birth to Moshe at 130? It's Rashi. It's a Gemara. In fact, it's coming up in the Daf Yomi a few days from now, and in Baba Basra. And the impetus to say she was 130 when Moshe was born was a different parish that appears in Bereishis. It's on this page here. It's actually source number 93. If you probably don't have that either.
Anybody want it?
Okay, this long box here in the middle of the page is to try to figure out how many people went with Yaakov to Egypt. It says that 70 did.
But
and yet, when you count them one by one, and this is the count, he mentions all of them. You count them and you see that there are 69. So he quotes the Medrash in the middle of the page. He says that Vidrash, the fourth line, you see Vidrash ki yocheved nolda ben hachomos. See it there? The Drash says that Yocheved's mother, who was Levi's wife, Yocheved is Levi's daughter, right, the Bas Levi means Mamish Bas Levi. So Yocheved was born just as they got to Egypt.
Right.
So they left Canaan with 69.
And
they reached Egypt with 70.
Right.
You with me?
Yep.
Okay. So you hear it all? So this is the explanation. But if Yocheved was born when they just got to Mitzrayim.
Oh my goodness.
And Moshe was 80 when they left, and they were there for 210 years, you can do the math here.
Oh.
Right? So he says, I cannot accept such a drash. So how do you make up the number 70? Remember what Ibn Ezra says on that? Ooh. So that's the Rosh. Ibn Ezra didn't go there. I would have preferred if Ibn Ezra had gone there.
I didn't hear what she said.
It rounds it off from 69 to 70. The Rosh at the end of Pesachim gives all the cases in the Torah where the Torah rounds off numbers.
No.
And this is one of them.
Not on
Ibn Ezra says the number 70 was Yaakov. It says, B'shivim nefesh, yidu avosechem Mitzrayim. 69 descendants, and he's 70. What's the problem? I'll tell you what the problem is, Ibn Ezra. In the beginning of Shmos, it says, Kol Yotzei Yerech Yaakov Shivim Nefesh. You're not a Yotzei Yerech of yourself. It says 70 descendants of Yaakov went to Egypt. So that's not a Teretz either. Okay? All right. So Ibn Ezra goes through a whole Arichus with all the mathematical details over why it's impossible that she was 130, not least of which. He says, I'm okay with a 130-year-old woman giving birth. There's a Kabbalah and a Kabbalah. But the fact that the Torah in Bereishis makes such a big deal about Sarah giving birth at 90, when people were still living 180, 210, and is silent when someone gives birth at 130,
right,
when people weren't living more than 120 anymore, come on. I don't get it. Right? So that's the question. Which Kabbalos will Ibn Ezra accept, and which will he reject? So we'll start to present that next time. Next time I want to give you actually the source of where it says in Kabbalah Nekabel. Where did he get this Lashon? It's a Mishnah in Yevamos. I want to look at that Mishnah and see how it affected Ibn Ezra's Perish. And now I want to conclude for today with just a few stories about him. You have a mathematical tendency. See if you can figure this out. There were two men who were traveling in a caravan. And just as the caravan was about to leave, a very wealthy man just huffed aboard and said, can I join the caravan? I must get to where you're going, and I have an emergency. And they were very gracious. They took him on. He said, I feel terrible. I have no food whatsoever. If you would be so kind as to share your food with me, I will reward you handsomely. One man had 3 loaves of bread. The other man had 2 loaves of bread. And they very graciously divided the bread equally between the 3 of them for the whole entire trip. And when the trip was over, he laid down 5 gold coins, which could have bought 1,000 loaves of bread. He laid down 5 gold coins and said, for your graciousness, I would like you to share these coins. The one who had 2 loaves said, he said, share the loaves. 2.5 for you, 2.5 for me. The one who gave 3 loaves said, no, that doesn't sound right. I should get 3 and you should get 2. I gave him a bigger share, right? So they decided they would take the answer. In the town that they were going, they would look up a wise man and they would ask for a psak halacha. They, as the story goes, came across to Ibn Ezra. It's not that they purposely went to him, but they saw that there's a wise man in this town. They asked him what to do. He heard the case and immediately paskened of what to do. He gave 4 coins to the man who had 3 loaves. He gave 1 coin to the man who had 2. And he said, you said you would obey? And he said, I'll explain it to you. And there's no arguing. It's very pashut. If they've split the loaves equally, so divide those 3 loaves into 15 pieces, right? And each one got 5. Right? So if each one got 5, how many pieces did the man with 2 loaves give him? Gave him 1 piece. Because he took 5, he had 2 loaves. Each loaf was divided into 3, and so he had 15 pieces. Right? Each one got 5 pieces. The man with 2 loaves gave him 1 piece. The man with 3 loaves gave him 4 pieces. So that's why he divided the coins that way. Okay, so the book that I have with like 100 stories like this, where a surprise ending, and Ibn Ezra, so I'll just tell you the one more that's really very, very endearing. Ibn Ezra was traveling, and as usual, no one knew who he was. He's sitting in Shoal with no place to go, no place to sleep, no place to eat, and no one invites him to take him home.
Right? That's terrible.
So he's sitting in the Shoal in the back row, and the shamas is cleaning up Kiddush and putting away Siddurim. And the shamas looks at him and says, do you have any place to go now? And he says, no, I was hoping someone would invite me. He goes, well, I'll take you home to my place. Of course, the shamas of the shul was the poorest man in town and had a very, very bad accommodations and hardly any food at all. Ibn Ezra's eating with him, and they have just a small piece of bread and a small piece of meat, and that's dinner. They finish, and he brings a bench with the start of the bench. He goes, what? There's no more food in the house? He goes, well, there's... He goes, don't you have any fish for Shabbos? And he says, there's a little fish, but that's for lunch tomorrow. He goes, lunch? Forget about lunch. Let's just have the fish now. But before we have the fish, do you have an Erev in this town? He goes, why do you want to know? He goes, I just want to know, do you have an Erev? He goes, yes, there's an Erev. This whole city is surrounded by an Erev. He goes, fine. So he says, let's eat the fish now. So they eat the fish. He says, let's bench. He goes, do you have anything else? He goes, yeah, there's a little herring, but that's for Shal Shudis. Shal Shudis? It's nighttime now. Who's thinking about tomorrow? Let's eat the fish. And he convinces the guy to eat the fish. He's left with no more food for the rest of Shabbos. The next morning, he sells to the shamas, they're getting up, and he goes, listen, do me a favor. I'd like to get to Shul nice and early. Can you walk me through? Yes, I always go to Shul early myself. I was going to tell you where to go. You know, and then he's coming. You come with me, and we'll go early. So they go early. He goes, tell me, where does the rabbi sit? And he points him right there. He goes and he sits in the seat. He calls out and goes, listen, when the rabbi comes, you got to get up. He goes, don't worry. The rabbi comes and he insists on sitting there. Not moving. and he holds on to the sides, and they try to pick him up, and the chair comes up with him, and nothing can get him to move from the seat. Right? He doesn't even get up to stand to, but Baruch Hu, he picks up, and he picks up the seat with him. And he davens Shmoneh Esrei with the seat. He doesn't move from the seat. So the whole show thinks he's nuts. The place gets packed, and it's time to say the Kriyas HaTorah. Take the Torah out, bring it to the Bima, and they're about to call people up. He runs from the rabbi's seat up to the Bima, and he starts darshaning on the parsha. And it doesn't take 30 seconds to a minute for everyone to see that there's something very special here. And they let him go, and go, and go, and go, and he keeps, and they want more, and he keeps saying, he said nothing, he goes, no, more, more, give us more. And he gave them Torah that they had never heard. So much so that after the davening was over, every single person in shul demanded that they come to his house for lunch, including the rabbi. So he told them, listen, I just want to tell you something. I traveled far and wide to meet my childhood friend, your Shamus. We grew up together. And I promised him that I would have lunch at his house. Right? You have an Erev in this town, right? He goes, yeah, yeah. Because you all want to eat with me? Good. Why don't you all bring all your food over, pick it up, bring it up, all of you, and we'll eat at my friend's house. And that's what they did. They had lunch in Shalosh Shudas. They had a feast at a friend's house. And that's the story. So the book is filled with these kind of stories by the Ibn Ezra. You know, how do we get to know a story like this? They don't write the stories about you and me like this. I don't know, man.
Wow.
But I don't know.
That's it. For you.
I'll tell each time we learn more about Ibn Ezra. I'll tell one or two more stories like this. And some that doesn't that have some very very, very surprised endings. Okay, so next week we'll continue with Ibn Ezra, and we'll get one more week out.